and here we go with the very special We Talk Comics. This is a special episode on one of our specials, non-numbered episodes, because this is a reward.
It's special.
Well, it's special. Well, you're special every week, Brett.
Thanks.
But it's a, you're welcome. It's a reward. Panel One is a local organization in Southern Alberta that is spreading everywhere that is designed to help to foster creativity and awareness for comic books, and especially largely independent comic book creators. And they had a Kickstarter in order to have a festival, and this festival was held. And the idea was to be able to give away the tables to free and not make any profit, not profit themselves, but allow everything to go back to the creators, which is something they managed to do, which is really, really cool. And among the Kickstarter rewards were a few podcasts that were available. This is the first of three podcasts that were given out as a reward for this Kickstarter campaign. And this one was bought by a sequential artist here in Calgary who does graphic recording. And Sam Hester is her name. Sam, thank you so much for showing up.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Absolutely. And you are multitasking.
That's right. Yeah, I'm folding my laundry.
Nice to know that we're the most important thing you're doing today.
Oh, this is like a wonderful holiday for me to sit here and quietly fold laundry and talk about comics. I've had a busy day with two children, so that's my non-comics life.
Yeah, I got a dog, you know, so yeah. We all have our crosses to bear. But she wanted to talk to a gentleman who is also joining us here, Damian Wilcox. Damian, thank you so much for also coming on and being Sam's guest.
Oh, thank you.
And so, Sam, why don't you tell everybody kind of what a graphic recording is? Why don't you kind of explain this concept a little bit?
Yeah, okay. Well, I only learned about graphic recording in 2012 for the first time. I've always taken notes while I doodle, which probably many, you know, people in the comics world just do without even thinking about it. And I didn't realize that the advent of those YouTube videos that show sped up animation visuals and just the incorporation of visuals in general into much more mainstream stuff in recent years has turned the field of graphic recording, basically like doodling and taking notes at the same time, into an actual line of work. So many organizations all over the world are now using this practice as a way to promote learning and engagement at all sorts of events. Graphic recorders just show up and take illustrated notes, and that kind of capture the highlights of what's going on at all sorts of different events. And that's what I've been doing for my job since about 2013.
You know, when I see it, I almost it reminds me of like some Egyptian, you know, storytelling here. And I could picture you doing this on a wall somewhere. And you know, it'd be capturing the story of the incidents of the day.
Yeah, maybe the Egyptians were onto something with that. The incorporation of pictures and the text were, they don't have to be separate. They can be kind of connected and be more effective that way.
And you want to talk Damian on. First off, I just want to say both of you, Damian Wilcox, Sam Hester, thank you both for having easy names to pronounce, by the way. We get so many people on here who I screw up. But those I'm not going to screw up, I promise. Yeah, unless I already did.
Mine's trickier with the spelling.
And you'll find a way to screw it up. It's okay.
Sam, from your perspective, tell us about Damian, who he is and why you wanted to talk to him.
Well, actually, I don't know Damian as well as I'd like to. That's why I wanted to talk to him. So I'm the best person to introduce him. But we our path first crossed in probably around 2002 or 3, back when we thought we were some of the only people in Calgary that we could find making independent comics. So that's sort of how we first kind of ran into each other. And since then, I think just the commitment that Damian's had to continue making independent comics ever since has just impressed me so much. It seems to be a similar commitment to what I've had in different ways, maybe. So I guess I felt like we had that in common, and I never get to hear enough about what you're doing. So tell us.
Oh boy.
No pressure.
Wow.
Start with like, tell me like when we first met each other, it was at the Red Skull Comics was starting up a Calgary Comics, independent comics group kind of thing. Was that right?
Let me see. This is a while ago. I thought, wasn't it at one of the comic shows? The like one of the Red and White?
Red and White Club?
Yeah.
What I remember is like,
uh-oh.
No,
get your story straight, Hester.
Okay, well, let me start with where did I come into this story? Was from a illustrated kind of autobiographical journal of comics about what's going on in my life that I started writing when I was an art student at OCAD in Toronto. And I was from Calgary, and I moved back to Calgary, and I kept writing these independent comics. Like, I didn't even know there was a word independent comics. And I was lucky to end up getting a couple of my little stories published here and there. And because of that, I was connected with Kelly Dowd from Red Skull. And he said to me, you should come and meet some of these other comics people. And he was maybe even the one who pointed me toward the event at the Red and White Club back then. So I don't remember the day or the time that we met, but I know it could have been either one of those.
I think it was at one of the shows for sure. Yeah. And I definitely remember because I was babysitting your table because you were late.
That's okay. I was trying to remember if I had ever been at that Red and White event, and I was like, yeah. I think I was there, but I couldn't come. So yeah, it was you. Okay.
Because you showed up near the end, I think it was, and that was when you were doing a lot of traveling and you were flying back from like Germany or somewhere.
That's so funny that I was thinking just before this talk, like if I was to try to remember things in Calgary that I've been involved in, and I was thinking that I couldn't remember being at that Red and White Club event long ago, and that's because I was a flight attendant and I worked on the flight to Germany. That was my regular job for 15 years.
Yeah.
And I didn't make it until like the end of the event.
Yeah, I think you missed pretty much the entire show.
Like that's why I can't remember. There you go.
And that might be the show when I had my paper mache ninja I was trying to get rid of.
Did you get rid of it?
The cheapest table you ever had, eh, Damien?
It wasn't even a table. That was the problem. It didn't do anything. It just, and it was like 4 feet high. And I wanted to get rid of it, so I just took it to the show. And in the last 10 minutes, I was like begging people to take it. And I think someone took it for like $1 or something.
So that Red and White Club show, I know it still goes on now, but that was like Calgary's original comics get together, right?
Yeah, that was the, well, there was a few other ones. So like the very first one I went to was Doug somebody, I forget his last name, and it was I forget what he called it, Calgary Comics something.
Like, is it like sci-fi con kind of?
He had one at the university.
Okay.
In the little center across from McEwen Hall, and it charged entirely too much for tables for that event.
Oh, I never even heard of that. Because there was one at the downtown, the old convention center that was.
Oh yeah.
I was a panelist in that one with like three other people who were like talking about the future of comics in Canada, and like I didn't know, but none of us knew what it was.
Yeah, I went to that show one time. But I didn't really attend that show too much. And then the Red and White Club seemed to be kind of the usual annual one until the Calgary Expo exploded.
So does it seem to you, and maybe all of you guys too, like it does to me, that there was sort of this interest in comics around that kind of early 2000 kind of time, and then it just sort of vanished for a while until the Calgary Expo picked it up? Or was it really all going on and I just missed it?
We probably all have a very different perspectives on this, I have to say. But this is an interesting question, so we'll go around the horn on it and let Keith go first here.
I remember when I first moved to the city, actually, in 92. But most of those shows were like a flea market with one person signing comics. Mm. One of the first – I remember a show – Mike Grell was here for a show. It must be 15 years ago.
That was a very long time ago. That was
actually more. That'd have to be more than 15 years.
That ago. Would, yeah, I think that would actually probably be closer to like 20, even 25.
Yeah, so sometime in the mid 90s. So there were kind of the odd, but yeah, like I said, they were more like a flea market show. Like you didn't have the big dealers. You had the people who were, you know, selling long boxes out of their basement kind of stuff, which is, some of what the Red and White Club still is. Those people have mostly been priced out of the Calgary Expo.
Yeah.
The Calgary Expo, you've got two big problems. One, it's an expensive show, of course, but it's also, 4 days. So if you're just selling them out of your basement, that's a huge time commitment to stand at a table.
Brett, what do you think here of this question?
Well, I think it's interesting because one of the things that I remember for a long time being a comic book fan was that the only way that you are going to get somebody's autograph and going to see a creator that you're interested in is having a signing at a store.
Yeah.
But you didn't actually have that many signings at a store. It's not like now where you have Alpha Comics who's, you know, having a signing every couple of months, basically, or even more so. And I think...
Who do we have in the early 90s? Like, the Hernandez brothers. Words and Pictures at the University was the one that brought in... So the Hernandez brothers, Neil Gaiman and Dave McKean, when they were promoting Mr. Punch. Those are the ones that are really clear to me.
Yeah, like, I remember that Dave Sim mm-hmm. came there.
That was the halfway point for Cerebus, the 150th.
Yeah, and what's his name? Dan Barretten was one of those guys as well. You know, and I think that, because you and I, Keith, we were at the very first Calgary Expo show. So, I mean, when it started off 10 years ago, it was really small.
Mm-hmm. We had a table at that first show.
Yeah, we had tables at, like, the first two, I think.
Yeah.
And... You know, it was such a small show in the Big Four, and it had a few comic book people, you know, probably in the 5 to 10 range kind of thing. So it was similar in scope to what you would see to the Red and White Club show now. And I think that, you know, because it only happened once a year, it did start to roll, and then they realized that they could get more people through the door and gather more money by inviting the bigger guests. And so I think that's kind of forced the comics out a little bit, but...
But even despite the changing events, did you guys feel that there was a community or, you know, not even a group, but like a disparate bunch of different local creators, like people interested in making comics in Calgary? Like, there's always been fans of comics in Calgary, but...
I don't know. I don't really know if we did realize that there was the... larger group.
Not the extent.
I can say that I mean, as far as the show didn't know, wasn't there Red and White Club? I'll come back to your question in a moment here, Sam, but then the Red and White Club, wasn't it another show in there first? Because isn't that where we saw, you know, Kurt Busiek and these guys walking around just getting comics while they were there signing tables and stuff, and they would bring in one guy from Star Trek, wasn't there?
That was the Red and White Club show.
Was it still the Red and White Club? It was different promoters then at the time and everything, obviously. And a very different style show and bigger. That was like 1994. Comics were, you know, still the boom had just started to come back down, I guess, about then. But and so, I mean, you would go there, and I don't really know, you know, as many times as I would go to comic book shops, and you would always be able to go in and be able to talk to people. I don't recall anybody saying, "Oh, I'm working on a book," like I seem to hear it now. So right. it was for a long time the hero to people when they go into these shops. They would talk about, well, McFarlane, because he had some roots from Calgary, and Howard Cobb, who had done Virus for Dark Horse, and is now kind of like a painter, and I think he lives at Camrose or something like that. And still in Alberta, but, you know, talks about getting back into comics, but, I mean, he couldn't really make a living at it, despite the fact that he had a book that ended up being a you know, major movie with Jamie Lee Curtis in the 90s come out from it.
Sorry,
go ahead.
I was just going to ask, didn't Howard Cobb have, like, a mini-comic years back? I seem to remember seeing his name on some of the mini-comics.
It's possible. I don't recall if he did, but all I know is that those were the only two artists that we knew. That and John Byrne also had roots in Calgary, you know? And so we would kind of grab onto that, hey, there's cool people with roots in Calgary. But as far as people who are currently working, like you have now, you know, both people who are having some mainstream major success, but also a small independent community. And those people with those mainstream success, people like Riley Rossmo and even Fiona Staples, they still have a tie to this other edge of the community, the independent spirit. And that I don't think is, yeah, I mean, if it existed, I sure didn't know about it.
Hmm.
Well, the two big differences we have since the 90s is, I mean, one, we've got webcomics, obviously, which is a huge difference. Sorry, I've still got a cough. And the other is just printing. Well,
then why don't you hang up? Oh, sorry.
Sounds good. Plus, just no. Printing has gotten cheaper. I mean, if you wanted to do an independent back then, you had to photocopy the thing.
Yeah, I did a lot of that.
When did you start, Damien? When did your book, your comic, or your website, Dork Boy Comics, for people who want to check it out? When did you start doing your thing? As I think that's what Sam said, is she kind of saw you as like the godfather of the independent scene here.
I've actually heard that a few times, and I'm surprised about that because I had no idea. I just kind of accidentally started making comics and kept making them, and I wasn't really aware of. I saw a few other mini comics. So I just figured that's what people were doing, and just kind of kept making my comics and started going to shows and things. But it's been just a little over 20 years now. And it started out with like a Christmas card. Basically, I created like a 5-page comic as a Christmas card for like friends and family and coworkers and stuff, and just photocopied it on like giant 11x17 paper that I folded in half. and I had no idea about the whole mini comic scene or anything like that. So, it was fairly well received, and I had fun making it. So I thought I'd make another one. And at some point I got this silly idea of like asking the local magazine store if they'd want to carry some copies. And as one place took it, then I started asking more and more places, and eventually got it into like coffee shops and comic stores and more places. And then just kept making, more and more issues over the years. And like I said, starting to attend shows and meeting people like Sam who are also, you know, creating their own comics and other people. So I just kind of figured there was already, it was just something people were already doing. So I'm not sure I necessarily deserve that title, but
well, you just were doing it when I started doing it, and I was so excited because I had been involved with some independent comics people in the States. I was lucky to get one of my first stories published in this book with all these like really famous people. So I went to a bunch of signings and comics expos in the States, and I saw all these scenes that were going on there. And when I came back to Calgary, I was really excited to have that in Calgary. And there was nobody except for you. So then I was like, you're the hero of Calgary.
Oh, no. We're doomed. Sure.
Tell me about the work you did with Shannon Wheeler. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. So I ended up kind of becoming friends with Shannon over he did a comic called Too Much Coffee Man and more of an independent comic for a number of years, and I don't read a lot of comics, but I stumbled across that one and kind of resonated and had his struggles of creating mini comics and a number of other things, and the humor kind of fit the type of humor I enjoy. So I ended up contacting him on email and just kind of getting to know him over several years. And at some point we ended up writing an opera together, a Too Much Coffee Man opera. I should say I wrote most of it probably, but it was just like over the course of about 5 years, we
including music. I'm sorry. Including music.
Oh no, I didn't do the music at all. That was,
but there is music. I see dollar signs. An opera about too much coffee, dollar signs.
Yeah, well, they put it on in Portland and then San Diego Comic-Con 1 year, and it's been put on several times in different locations in the U.S. So I managed to see the opening of it. There was another guy, Daniel Stephen Kratz. He did all the libretto or the music for it. And then I kind of did a lot of the writing. But it was really... at the time I was sending out little poems to my coworkers that I thought were funny. Shannon was on my email list as well. And then we started discussing doing an opera. So I'd just kind of start putting little snippets together and emailing it to him. And then eventually it amassed into this full blown, opera that, that happened at one point in time.
It was a project that, like, you know, in different parts of the world, that was a sort of a big event for the indie comics world. But no one in Calgary heard of that, I don't think. Did they?
Yeah.
But that's why we had that in common, because I was always traveling with my job and I was doing things in other places because that's where I thought interesting things were going on. And then in Calgary, there was no scene and there was nobody who was interested in what we were working on.
Yeah.
So for me, that led me to kind of drop out of the Calgary scene. But you, that's why I was so happy when I found a few years later, like, oh, you're still doing this. I thought maybe you had, you know, like me, kind of given up for a while.
No, I was oblivious to if there was a scene or not. I was just, as far as I was concerned, I was just making comics and I pretty much had blinders on in terms of what else was going on. The only time I kind of dropped out of things was probably 2005 or six. So I'd been doing print comics for a number of years. I had a website, but, you know, was scared of putting my comics on the website because, you know, people could obviously download them and make millions off of them or something. But
I have a brilliant idea now. Excuse me, I write that down.
Yeah, compared to where we are today, right? So, but the thing was, I mean, I'd been doing the print comics for years. I'd gone to San Diego a couple times and tabled there. I'd been going to a number of comic shows in Calgary and Vancouver and that sort of thing. And what started to happen was I was getting burned out on comics. I was getting burned out on the business of comics, and there was some run-ins with potential things happening, like one with a publishing thing that fell through and another with a potential TV show thing that fell through. And just I found at some point I was just getting sick of all of the business side of it. So I stopped going to conventions. I stopped taking my books to stores. I pretty much stopped everything. The only thing I didn't stop was making comics. I just kept making comics, but everyone, I didn't see a lot of people for a while because I wasn't going to the shows or anything like that. So I think a lot of people thought I just quit or something. And that was when the Calgary Expo was starting up. So I didn't attend for the first several years. I think I was convention free and business free for maybe 4 or 5 years. And then at some point I thought, well, it's, you know, it'd be nice to see everyone and kind of go out there and put my stuff out there. Cause I was doing everything completely online, publishing all my stuff. And it seemed like the audience was growing in terms of the online audience, but local people, I think, had no idea I was still making comics. So I started going to the show, going to the one show again, just Calgary Expo, and just limiting. I decided I didn't really want to keep running my book around to stores, and I didn't want to do a lot of the other business stuff because I've got a full-time job and things like that. So I just didn't want it to become what it did before, where it was taking up too much time, and most of it wasn't the actual comic making itself. But on that note, let me introduce an awkward silence.
Ask us some questions, you guys. We don't know what to talk about. Well,
so you guys, okay. Well, let's a subject that I'd like to move on to, Sam, that you had brought up was the idea of using comics more in education. I guess you have some theories on this. I mean, obviously, what you're doing has some roots in that already. But what do you mean, kind of, when you talk about the idea of using comic books to help educate a little more?
Well, actually, there's two different streams for that thought. One is the work that I'm doing as a graphic recorder, which most graphic recorders and graphic facilitators, as they're called, are very strict about saying it's not about the art. It's only about using visuals in some way to let your mind work on two tracks with words and visuals together. But that can promote education, that can help people learn, but it's not about, that's not an artistic practice. It's just the idea that more than one thing, you know, can augment the whole experience. So I am interested in that for my graphic recording side of things. But what I'm really interested in more, just for my own personal love of this subject for some reason, is for comics to be incorporated more into academia. Not to use them as a learning tool necessarily, but to let comics be a legitimate format for scholarship to happen in. So instead of writing an essay or instead of publishing a paper, you could publish a comic with the same kind of high-level, serious, important content, but with pictures and with, you know, sequential panels. And that's something I've always just thought it just made sense. Why wouldn't it be? But it's been a long road to where it's slowly becoming, I think, accepted in places, but not everywhere yet.
still got that bit of a stigma in North America.
Yeah, definitely. Well, even, I don't know, I guess I don't know as much elsewhere. Do you think there are other places where it's taken, I mean, it's taken more seriously as a high art form, but as an academic thing?
Academic, I'm not sure. I would hope it is in Japan, but I don't know. But it does, I get the feeling that in Europe it's regarded a little more highly as an art form. Well, again, I don't know about academic, but...
There's a comics artist in Germany, Reinhard Kleist, he's written some comics about some... He's written some biographies as comics, like you read about Johnny Cash and some other, you know, real people in the world.
Yeah.
And because of his awesome work, he's working for the... It's like the German cultural ministry, kind of, the Goethe Institute, going around the world and doing live drawing and writing comics about other countries and what he sees there, kind of as a... like being an ambassador for German culture in a way, and like to use comics in that area is awesome.
Yeah, well, and Japan similarly has. I mean, they pretty much put anything in anything into comics, like every genre. There's no limitation, and I see those lines kind of broadening North America as well. But it just seems to be more pervasive there.
Is that right?
Sorry?
You've spent a lot of time in Japan. Is that right?
A fair bit. Usually we tend to visit there every year for a few weeks. And then I've been trying to capture some of the more interesting tidbits in comic form when we travel.
Hmm. Well, the academic question, I guess there's only one other thing that, well, I don't know, I have lots of thoughts about it, but I'll say that I was encouraged that there was a scholar who a couple of years ago published a PhD thesis as a comic. Have you guys heard of that guy? Nick Susenis and his book Unflattening?
No, afraid not.
Oh, it's so crazy that no one's heard about this guy. So I have to tell you that he wrote a PhD, I think he was at Columbia University, and his PhD was published by Harvard University Press, the very first PhD thesis that was published as a comic. And then after that was published, after he wrote his PhD, he graduated, he was accepted to do a postdoc at the University of Calgary. He spent an entire year in Calgary. He was nominated for an Eisner Award, and he's become an international lecturer talking about his book, the first time academics welcomed a complete comic into the academy. And nobody in Calgary had heard of this guy. It blew my mind. And now he left. He went to San Francisco to have an awesome teaching job where people appreciate him. So... It's one thing I noticed about the Panel One festival, which was like a really amazing group of new creators who are really doing amazing stuff. But there seems to be these disconnects between the creators and the educators and different places where comics could happen. But I think in Calgary, there's so much scope for more connections that just are waiting to happen. So that was just one example where it didn't happen.
I do think that's one of the things the Panel One hopes to achieve down the road, but it needs somebody to come in there and maybe say, this is where this, to point that out and to bring solutions to the table for how you get there. Because I mean, I think there's a lot of people who are willing to put arms together and walk forward and try and do it, but perhaps they don't know where to start.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, because I mean, comics creators are usually, you know, like Damien just saying, like, just making comics because you love doing it, not because you are even connected to necessarily any community. And would it occur to you to call up the university and say, hey, do you want to come to our festival? Because we, you know, maybe you like comics too, or whatever, any group, not just the university.
That's right. You know what? You don't have to think of, if you're going to hold a festival, you don't have to think to get the word out to just the comic book people. I mean, how do you get it out to different people how do you think laterally and get it out to different people that may have interest in it, but they don't realize it and they just don't realize it's going on and see it as something different. That's absolutely true. And, you know, and the thing is, comic books making, I mean, the reason Panel One was started was because it's such an isolating experience. And when people started to realize there was a community there, it was the idea of support system isn't the right word, but yeah, that sense of community, it's a good feeling. You're still going to have to go in and make that book all by yourself. I mean, I remember seeing on one of Damien's website, one of his comics saying, you know, I think it was something along the lines of the scariest thing comic book artists can see before and after, you know.
Oh, the the two stages of comic creation.
Yeah, yeah. What is that? Can you explain that one?
Yes. So it was like the first panel was is kind of me sitting at the table thinking, oh, I hope I don't screw this up. And then the second panel was the comic was finished, and I'm saying, oh, I wish I hadn't screwed that up.
and we hear that kind of thing often, you know? Yeah. Like, and yeah, I mean, just having people to bounce by ideas off of and you know, talk to about it, it seems like such a good idea.
Yeah. I had a moment like that when I first went to the San Diego Comic-Con because I had just gotten a computer and I got the internet and I didn't ever had that before. And when I looked online, I searched comics and I found this like Comic-Con and I had never heard of that. So I thought I should go to this thing. And I was a flight attendant. So back then I could just get on an airplane and go. So I just went there and I didn't know anybody. I didn't know anything about it. But awesome. I met, it was so crazy. It was before September 11th of 2001 when it was a little bit more of a restriction on ability to just hop on an airplane.
Yeah.
That. But before then, it was more flexible, and that was such a great opportunity for me. Anyway, when I went there, I met a bunch of cool people talking about comics, and someone said, you've really got to read this book. I think it was by Eddie Campbell. It was just like a comic book I'd never heard of, and someone said, you should write that down. So I said, oh, I have to find a pen. And in that moment, like six people extended to me a hand holding like a super amazing, awesome drawing, fine art ink pen of a different sort. And I just thought, oh my God, I'm totally at home. Like I've never seen six hands at once holding pens like this. Like this is really cool.
Yeah. The first time I went down to San Diego, I kind of like ran around and just like, cause I, like I said, I didn't read a ton of different authors, but, I went up to like David Mack and Adrian Tomeem, Brian Ralph and Jordan Crane, and I think I maybe made a little faux pas as well, but I just go up and talk to them, and there was another guy, David Cho. He did some independent comics, and I think he was talking to what's the guy that I think he owns Marvel now, Jim Lee. Maybe.
Oh, Jim Lee is with a major position in DC.
Yeah, and he used to be a comic artist and do like all of the superhero stuff.
And he still is.
I think they were talking, and I was like, I went.
I love that you don't really know who Jim Lee is. Like you have no idea. This is arguably the biggest name in comics. He's huge. He just designed all the characters and stuff like that for Scooby Doo and redesigned them and all the characters for the New 52 in DC. And you're making comics and you don't really know who he is. And I think that's freaking great. I mean, please go ahead with your story.
Well, so I mean, I'm pretty sure it was him because he wears a little baseball cap, right? And they were talking, and I kind of walked up to them, and I was like, oh, hey, because I wanted to talk to the one guy, but I didn't really know who Jim was very much. So, and like I said, David Cho was just more doing the independent, smaller comics and that sort of thing. So, and that was probably like 2002, maybe or something like that. I was surprised to see so many creators there that, I mean, ones that I wanted to see. And then there was, you know, the whole ecosystem of other creators that I just wasn't familiar with. Not much inhibition. I just kind of run up and talk to people. And that was one of the funnier occurrences back then.
That is a story we hear as I go to the different panel one events and some of the drink and draws. It's very, very frequent to hear people say things like, you know, I met one person that liked that was making comics, and I thought that it was just the two of us in the city. So we sat in the basement and made comics for years, but there's everyone, like there's this whole group of people. Mm-hmm. it was a sudden growing of community because all of a sudden it wasn't just the two of you that had found each other. There were like 20 or 30 people in the room all of a sudden.
Yeah, I mean, seemed like it kind of grew at some point, like before the Calgary Expo. It seemed like it kind of exponentially got bigger fairly quickly. When was that? like maybe early 2000s. Like it really seemed like there was a lot of people creating, and it's, I think it's steadily grown, I would guess.
I know as recently as even this year, I've run into comic creators who had their own book there. There were three of them at this year's expo that had no idea that there was anyone else from Calgary there.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think part of that might be to blame on the easy access to webcomics. Like, I mean, now it's so easy to just be at home, make a comic, upload it, get feedback online, maybe, if you're lucky, make another comic, upload it. but, like, years back, you if you wanted anyone to see it, you pretty much had to do the footwork and that sort of thing and get it out there. And just by virtue of walking around to stores and talking to people, like pretty much every shop owner I talked to when I was dropping off my books was working on a graphic novel at the time. so you'd find out that, so I mean, I always had the impression that everyone was making comics. Like everyone I talked to would be like, oh, I'm working on a graphic novel. I'm like, oh, wow. Okay. That's
just in Calgary?
An undertaking.
Just in Calgary or in other places too?
Oh, Calgary. Like I swear like 90% of the people working in the comic shops that I talked to would be like, oh, I'm working on a graphic novel. And I was like, okay, well, that's kind of makes sense. You're working.
Yeah.
The idea to that was that it was a gateway. Of course, the problem with most gateways, especially when it comes to comics, is that it's way easier to just keep reading them than it is to create.
Well, that was the thing, because I learned that after a few years, because I'd go back to the same shops and talk to the same people and I'd be like, oh, hey, how's your graphic novel coming? And I'm on like issue 3 or 4 or whatever. And they're like, oh, I, you know, kind of decided to go back to the beginning and rework it. And yeah, you kind of learn about that classic trap of comics where you get so far in and then you're not happy with anything you've created and you want to go back to the beginning and start over and you just stay in that circle and you never finish the book. And I think that happened a lot to people, and it's a slog to get it done. Graphic novels are not the right place to start.
But there's not always the right kind of encouragement for people who are starting out if they sometimes only see a certain genre of comics and they think it has to be like that.
Yeah.
Or I think Damien, you and I once talked about how people might think you have to have an inker and a letterer and a script writer and all these different people to be part of a project, when, you know, with the advent of indie comics becoming so popular with all everybody's little mini comics and zines, it doesn't mean that everybody's going to like it, but you don't have to have a team of people. You can just make your own thing, and it's just satisfying.
Yeah, so, I didn't even know any other comic people, even if I would have had the thought to try and divvy up the work.
No.
Well, and I think that's it. You know, like the larger the community is getting now is good, but there was, like you say, this large community before of everybody thinking that they were working on something. But then the problem is that you can think that you're writing a comic book, but you can't necessarily think that you're drawing a comic book at the same time. And I think that it was hard for those people at that point who were maybe the writers to connect with those people that were the artists. And then everybody was just kind of moving parallel to each other, and they were never intersecting.
Yeah.
I also think society has a little bit more of a to hell with it, I'm just going to do it attitude.
Yeah.
You know, that just more freedom. Like, you know, I mean, you put it out there and you just, I don't know, you know, you're not as worried about people think. Some people like us, some people won't. I don't think that there's the same. I think that's one thing that's allowing people to, more people are getting it done, because that's what we always hear as a comic book, is just get it done. And those people don't get it done. If they say they will and they still say they will, you know, a year later, then they won't. But there are a lot of people who are just like, okay, I'm just going to print it. I'm just going to print it. I'm going to get it out. Maybe I'll lose money on it, but at least I tried. And I think there's just that more feeling of taking your shot. Seems like it's just more of a, I don't know if it's a societal thing or is it just, you know, just in comic books, but I feel like it's out there more.
But you got to think that 20 years ago, Image Comics was you know, blowing up. The comics market was enormous. So, I mean, people wanted a piece of that pie. And to get a piece of that pie, you were trying to tell a story like Image Comics or something like that and do a very superhero-y book. So, you know, those kind of people, they were less likely to get it done. Now that comics are, you know, kind of smaller in that regard, but bigger in their own way. You know, there's a lot more independent ways to get your comic out, for sure.
Yeah. Well, there's so many more places that comics can be. Like, comics journalism wasn't something that people would have thought about maybe 20 years ago, but now someone who's maybe not a great, I don't know, colorist or letterer or some official role that used to be, but has the spirit of being a journalist and would have usually gone down a more mainstream track to become a journalist, could now take that outlet into their comics. Like, that's...
And for instance, any idiots can start a podcast.
Yes. Yes.
Very low barrier to entry for producing hundreds of hours of nonsense.
It's the same for webcomics, same for everything. I mean, that's one of the, I think, the best things of where we're at right now is that, like before, there was always a lot more work into getting anything started, any sort of endeavor. And now, you know, whether it's comics, whether it's podcasts, whether it's making your own movie, I mean, there's so many more avenues. It's less of an issue of access and more of an issue of motivation and effort.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you talk about going into every comic shop and someone was working on a graphic novel. I mean, you went into any video store and someone's working on a screenplay.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's just, there's a natural connection of who's drawn to that environment as well.
Yeah.
So the sample group is not, you're definitely not looking at a broad sample group from society. You're looking at a very specific group of people who are willing to work for $5 an hour at a comic store because they just want to be surrounded by comics all the time.
Well, I think the reason it stood out to me was because, like, when I first started taking my comics to stores, I didn't start with the comic stores, and I was kind of, I mean, I'd go into comic stores a little bit, but I mostly wanted people that weren't reading comics to read my comics, so I ended up taking it to magazine stores. I even made little stands so that I could get it into coffee shops and things like that, and not like pre-Starbucks, like the roastery and that sort of thing. So I got them into all, like, a bike shop took some comics. I had them all over the place in Calgary. They're like a virus that kept spreading. And then, like, over the course of time, I got them into more and more comic stores. And then I noticed the distinction. Like, I'd go into the comic store and I'd see, like, people like, oh, I'm working on a comic. And, like, I'd go into the magazine stores and coffee shops and, you know, they weren't like, oh, I'm working on a super powered coffee bean that's going to take over the city. So there's a bit of a difference.
No, the coffee shop, they're also doing screenplays in the coffee shop. Yeah.
Well, actually, like, my fifth Dork Boy book was totally based around this coffee story in the coffee shop in Kensington that was selling my books at the time. And it had this, like, mental Morcaccino character that was tainting the coffee beans. I won't get into it. It's a... bizarre, complicated.
Feed me, Seymour.
Since we talked about barriers to entry, I mean, Brett mentioned, you know, 20, 25 years ago when the industry was crazy big as far as, you know, sales through comic shops went, that barrier was totally different. Like, what, it wasn't even convincing store owners at that point. You had to convince Diamond that your printing was of the right quality, you could get it out in a timely manner. And Diamond, even though it seemed like they would carry everything, still didn't carry the zine type things.
Oh, I
you still had to look like a comic.
Yeah,
you still weren't being that kind of quality.
Yeah, I went through that whole process. So, like, after I'd done, I'd done several, like, mini comics of Dork Boy, and I started another comic called Workin' Jones, and like, I had all these comic titles going on. And I knew Diamond won't carry mini comics or anything like that, so. At that point, like, the last issue of Dork Boy I did, I printed like 1,000 copies or something like that. So I thought maybe I should look into, looking into Diamond kind of came about was I was at a comic show and there was a guest sitting next to me and I didn't really know who they were very much. And I was like just cracking jokes with his wife while I was waiting for the clock to wind down. And she started looking at one of my books and she was really liking it and she showed it to him. And then they got in touch later and they were going to put out a book. So I kept in touch with them and they put an ad in previews, they got some orders and then financially they weren't doing great. And it came down to, They said if I went and printed the book and gave it to them, they'd send it to Diamond. And I thought, well, I'm kind of already doing that myself, so I didn't really see any advantage. So I thought, well, maybe my next book I'll print like a standard comic size book, and I'll you know, go through the due process and send it out to Diamond and that sort of thing. Because I figured, well, Diamond's already accepted it once from this guy. Maybe I can just do the same thing. And the one he was going to put out was more of the collection of the mini comic stuff I'd already put out, and not new work. And I wanted to put out some new stuff. So I worked away on this book, got in touch with a printer, submitted it to Diamond. I figured even if they carried it or not, I was still going to print a bunch of copies. And they ended up not taking it. So I'd kind of gone through that process of and their cut is huge. I mean, it was like 40%, I think, back at that time off the cover price. And then there was another cut on there was another cut somewhere there as well. So it was really, it's just getting back to the comment about not being terribly friendly to independent publishers. So really, unless you were printing, because I printed over, I think I printed 2,000 of that book maybe, but really back then, you had to print probably 5,000 or 10,000 to get the printing break so that your cost was low enough that you could price it at a reasonable, you know, standard comic price and still have them take all of their cuts out of it and not be paying to send your comics away, basically. So it just, it seemed to really favor the, you know, the large quantity comics, which makes sense. I mean, they're a business and they want to deal with publishers that are doing high volume and that sort of thing.
Now there's more conventions you can probably attend. You can sell it that way. You can sell it on your own website, and even a Comicosity, you know, or Comixology. I mean, obviously you have, there are standards to get, you know, through them, but I mean, places like this, it's easier to make it available without having to. That Diamond, that sounds like a nightmare. You know, yeah, when they became a monopoly, that was really bad for the industry, unfortunately.
Yeah, the landscape's totally different now. I mean, there's so many avenues you can go down. It's just putting in the effort. They at that point they really kind of controlled everything, and that was one of the contributing factors where I was like, you know, I just don't want to deal with the business side of this. I didn't want it to become a full-time job, and it was starting to feel like a job, which was making me not enjoy comics, and I didn't want that to happen. Today there's so many more avenues. I mean, you can publish it yourself. There's entire websites there's this one Webtoon. You can upload your comics for free, and people will vote on them. And that company is run by a company called Line, and they're out of Korea. And they'll actually, if the comic's doing well, they'll offer kind of paid comics on their main site, but then anyone can contribute to this other portion of the site as well. So it seems like there's a positive community there also.
You come at it from a little bit of a different point of view, though, don't you, Sam? Because I mean, you're doing slice of life, you know, about your own life type of web comics, I guess, and you know, in addition to the graphic recording, though. So it's not really designed to be distributed as a that kind of book. It doesn't seem, you know, the issue one, put it through Diamond, sell a bunch of copies anyways. It's a different type of thing.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've heard the name of Diamond. I never pursued publishing anything with them. I was only ever invited to submit pieces to publications that were happening from different independent.
They're not but they're a distributor to the comic book stores themselves. They're not a publisher. So you still need a publisher, and then they distribute it to the comic book stores for the publishers.
But my experience, right from the start, I started writing comics as part of an art school project in 1997, and this, the first time I met a publisher at the San Diego Comic Con a couple years later was the publisher of Alternative Comics, and then later I did a project with a guy who had just started a publishing house called Ad House Books. And those guys were just looking for autobiographical comics everywhere you could find and everywhere you could look, and my first introduction to the fact that there was an independent comic scene in the world was this book called 911 Emergency Relief, where a bunch of different artists contributed stories to a an anthology to which the proceeds went to the Red Cross following the attacks on the World Trade Center. And so that was the first time I read anybody else's independent comics of any kind, and they were all autobiographical. They were all about what was I doing on that day. So I thought that was a giant, and it is, I think it's a giant this section of the indie comics world. And I think that's exactly the kind of comics I write. They're just about what's going on in my life. So they wouldn't be in a serial, you know, they wouldn't look like a superhero comic, but there's people who write comics like that everywhere. I don't know, is that...
No, I'm just wondering what is the, for both of you, I mean, kind of, do you have an end game? Is there an end game? What do you see as your next evolutions for what you want to do?
I just
keep making comics?
Yeah, I mean, I've had that question come up before, and my answer is I'm doing what I want to be doing. So it's just continuing making comics, getting them out there. And I mean, even like over the years, I've had enough brushes with, you know, the potential of it becoming a job and that sort of thing, and different types of I guess what might be considered success or not, that I found I got a good taste of it where it wasn't something that I wanted to be a job. And I kind of made that decision a long time ago, which is, it's hard to find other people to talk with about that because there's very few. Sam's one of the great people that's like just really invested in, you know, the love of comics and I think isn't, you know, specifically trying to get some sort of publishing or movie deal or anything like that. That's not meant as a knock against
That can still work even if you love comics, but you're right. I'm not looking, I don't have an angle for where this is really going either. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's more, I mean, like as far as I'm going, if I was more focused on trying to build a specific audience, I think one of the things that I do frequently that counteracts that is if I feel like changing a comic or introducing a new title at any time, I just do it. And sometimes it works out for a bigger audience, sometimes a smaller audience. but it's just like over the years, I just continue to adapt and change and follow whatever path I'm enjoying in terms of making the comics.
And ultimately that makes the work more fun for your audience because it comes from a more real place than if you were trying to be more contrived about it, I think. Like it'll be the proof in the pudding. Like if you just keep following what you think feels the most authentic, then that's what people are going to end up liking after they see, you know, where it goes of its own accord. I feel like that for me, the most challenge I have now is because I'm doing art for my full-time thing in different kind of ways, my art is more contrived. Like I'm thinking always about what's the outcome, what's the deadline, what's that kind of thing. And I think my comics are worse when they're like that. So I'm trying to keep the balance of just letting it go where it's going to go, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, it is hard to have that balance of you know, keeping it pretty free. And that's the thing that like getting back to thinking about if, you know, if it were to be a full-time job or something like that, I didn't want it to be dependent on one specific character where your hands are tied. And if you go and do something different, it means that you can no longer pay the bills or something like that, which is, to me, just wasn't somewhere a position I wanted to be in. I wanted to have that freedom of, I guess starting out from it being more of a DIY effort of, if I want to change, I'll change. And people may like it, they may not like it, but really just focus on what I'm enjoying and wherever it goes from there.
Okay, Brett, anything you want to ask?
No, I think I'm pretty good. We're
Keith, you have any questions here? We're kind of getting up near the end of our time, so anything from you, Keith?
No. Let's let Chris jump in.
Chris, you got anything?
The only thing while talking to you, I remember walking down 17th Ave and always wanting to pick up the little dork boy comic books, and I never did, and I'm really regretting that today.
That's funny.
They seem to be
that,
in every shot.
You could have told us that. You could have off air told everybody but Damien that.
No, that's awesome.
Right, it was the 90s. I had a lot of comic books to buy, and I was very much poorer than I am now. Not like, that I'm not that.
You should have gone to the Rosary, because people there would just like color them in and all sorts of things. I was always surprised if anybody picked them up, and then like over time, I'd go into a shop and people would be like, "Oh, we've been waiting for," and I'm like, "What? There's people waiting for what?"
That's awesome.
Go ahead. Sorry, I was just gonna say just the fact that that people have been supporting and continue to support indie comics is been pretty nice. And Sam's done a ton of autobiographical books, and she's doing a ton of work for like the Ramsey neighborhood with her comics. It's nice that there's still like strong support, I think, in pockets of Calgary that kind of help build out the community there.
That is something that came up a couple of days ago. Alan Moore made another one of his pronouncements, which are always entertaining.
Yeah.
About how comics are basically stagnated because everyone just wants to read Batman. And one of my friends who doesn't read comics regularly said, like, is that really where comics are at? And I said, well, the top 10 movies are not where the art of movies is going to be. And the top 10 selling comics aren't where the art of comics are going to be. But there are 400 distributed through Diamond. There's web comics. There's small press. Like, you go to the shows and there's 100 comics you've never heard of when you walk through the Calgary Expo. Like, that's where the art of comics is being done.
Mm.
That's where it's being moved forward.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm actually surprised at what a comeback the superhero movies have made recently. Like, because in the 90s of doing like kind of the mini comics and things back then, it seemed like the focal point of comics was superhero content. And now it's kind of shifted to be, there were some superhero movies, and now it seems like the focal point of mainstream movies lately is so heavily focused on superheroes.
Yeah. Well, everything's cyclical when it's like that, though. It's what's hot right now.
But those movies are also appealing to a larger audience. It's not like before when those movies came out, they were appealing to fanboys, and now they're appealing to, all sorts of people. So,
yeah, that's true. Yeah. I feel like that's part of the stigma of comics kind of eroding a little bit there, though, and maybe that's why, because it does seem like it's comics in general are a little more broadly embraced.
Not read.
I think as a source material, it's become along the lines of, it's now above based on a video game. It's still below based on a book. But people are starting to see a lot of things that aren't superheroes being adapted. Things like Outcast and Preacher and Walking Dead that are getting large audiences on, TV and film.
Yeah, that's true.
They're seeing things that aren't superheroes that are coming out of the comics medium.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to give you guys a chance now to ask any last questions to each other, or say anything you want to your fans, or promote anything you want to do. Damien, why don't you go first?
Oh, first to ask?
First to do whatever.
It's a ton of rap. Whatever.
Ask Sam anything, ask me, or, I'm sure you have tons of questions for me. And
I do. Actually,
what was your name again? Let's go.
Why am I here?
I don't really have anything promotion wise or anything like that. I'd really like to hear, thoughts from Sam on where comics are today, and I'd really like to turn it over to Sam, because she does amazing work, and I've seen people over the years kind of pop up and do comics and then either get discouraged or move on to something else and drop out. But then there's also, there's been, at this point, there's quite a few people in Calgary that have been making comics for a number of years, and Sam's definitely one of them, and still doing, amazing stuff. So yeah, I'd just like to hear whatever she has to say.
Thanks, Damien. I think I have I have two thoughts that are summing up my thoughts on all this interesting stuff. One is that I read recently there was a call for papers put out by a couple of scholars, I think they're both in Ontario, who wanted to write a paper about the future of Canadian comics. And they were interested in studying not only those big name famous people that everybody might know, like Julie Doucette, they were more interested in like really local, up-to-date stuff that's happening right now. And, or at least they were considering how in the study of comics, you're often studying stuff that's happening pretty quick and happening pretty recently, as opposed to maybe when you're studying the great classic of literature from 300 years ago. This is really a new field that's changing all the time. So I was just really excited to hear that, you know, scholars are studying that, and that's a legitimate subject of interest in, you know, the thoughts of people around Canada these days. And I want to know what happens there. I'm interested to follow that story. And then the other thing that I was going to say to sum up my thoughts is that Calgary, people, it's kind of almost a cliche now that people say, well, Calgary's such a new city that things haven't been done here yet, so you can make it yourself, you can define it and do it on your own. And lots of people have said that and done their own new independent things, but I think it's still true, and especially in the area of comics, I think it's really true. Even though the Calgary Expo is such a big deal, there's so much scope for defining what we want the community to be in so many ways, and I'm excited about that too.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Boma, both for your time, and Sam. Well, thank you for your time and your money in support of Panel 1, and certainly you want to check out panel1.ca to find out more about Sam. And Damien, do you have yourself a profile up there?
I don't think so, actually.
I think they would love to add you.
I should your profile on. Look into that.
Why not? It's free. It's free. So thank you very much, though, both of you. This has been fascinating. Any last things from anybody else?
This is unrelated. Maybe you just want to wait till the recording's done. But
well, now we can't.
Now I've made it sound all questionable and that sort of thing. I haven't made it down to the is it Wednesday night, the drink and draw? It sounds interesting. It's tricky schedule wise. I was just wondering what the
there's a couple of them. There's ones that we get invited to and ones we don't. the panel one ones are often on a Friday or Saturday.
Okay.
But there's another one that we're just hangers on. So we don't get invited to all of them. There's a one that's more just our I have to draw something to get in.
Oh, really? I don't get invited. I don't get invited to any of them.
Oh. You have to slide a drawing.
That's okay. I wouldn't go anyways. but I don't get invited to any of them. That's all right.
I only know of I think there's a Wednesday one for there's a Facebook group or something.
We'll have to look into this so we can meet in person one time and
get this.
Well, weren't they going to do just for you some sort of instead of a drink and draw, some sort of barbecue and draw for you, Sam? So because you have kids and you can never get out of the house in the evenings. And
I think I suggested, let's just have it at my house one night, and then I won't have to go out anywhere and get a babysitter. So that hasn't happened yet. It still would work.
I don't know if that's the crowd you want to give your address to. I think that's a fair answer. That's true. Think that all the way through.
Very good point.
Well, thank you very much, both of you. And, we'll see you all next week. Next week, we were originally going to be talking about the works of writer Chuck Dixon. And there's been a change. Instead of talking about his work, Brett, what do you have to say?
Well, instead of talking about his work, I thought we should just talk to the man himself. So we're going to talk to Chuck Dixon about his work next week. And I thought that, we could talk about our favorites instead of anything else.
Yeah, we'll have some few questions for a man who in the 90s helped define Punisher and one of the men that broke Batman's back and one of the most famous storyline, Nightfall, of all time, for the Batman.
And let's be honest, he wrote all the comics.
And I think he did write every other comic as well, yes.
And a man I have said nothing bad about ever.
No!
And on that note, good night, everyone.
Thank you, you guys. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you too. Very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks, Amy.